Guys, listen, this is it. This is the big moment. This is my interview with Stephen Pressfield. If you don't know him, you should know him. He is the author of the novel, The Legend of Bagger Vance, which was made into a film. Stephen has never spoken terribly highly of the film. I have personally not seen it, but it has Will Smith and Matt Damon in it. And I believe Charlize Theron is the love interest. How great is that? One of your novels made into a major motion picture with three of the leading actors of their time. Jealous a little bit, but also Stephen is a little bit like a father figure to me, even though he doesn't know that. And I obviously didn't tell him because that would be so awkward. But as I'm reading his books and listening to his podcast interviews, of which he has so many, I'll try to list not an exhaustive selection, but maybe a top 10 favorite podcast interviews if you want to listen to more of him after you get done with this interview. He is wise. And he is kind, and he very frequently says things that you wouldn't expect. He also wrote a book that many of you may know called The War of Art. It's an incredibly important book for any novelist out there because it's all about resistance with a capital R. He's going to explain it in the podcast, so I'm not going to steal his thunder here in the intro. But this idea that there is a force that is out to stop us from doing our greatest good. The preparation you get through the War of Art is amazing, and over decades of fighting, striving, struggling, failing, and eventually winning, Stephen put together what I like to think of as a greatest hits book. It's called The Daily Pressfield, and I was fortunate enough that he sent me a copy in preparation for this interview. So I've been going through The Daily Pressfield on my Instagram channel. You can watch and follow along there. I would encourage you to buy a copy of this book, whether you buy the box set or you buy just the book itself. Go through this if you're a novelist. It really prepares you for the difficulty of writing books and not getting stuck at all of the common sticking places. And I think in ways that maybe he didn't even think about or intend, it also is going to help you be a better marketer because marketing, as we all know, is an exercise often in what feels like futility. So please do get out there and get a copy of The Daily Pressfield. Listen to this podcast, share it with friends. If you want more interviews with people like Stephen Pressfield, we need to move up yet another level in the reach that we get. And the best way to do that is for you to share this with friends. Rate the show on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. It takes just a few moments. It doesn't have to be anything major. Just hit a star rating. And then tell people you know about this, writers who need to hear this, share it with them, and we'll bring on more guests like Stephen Pressfield. Thanks so much, and please enjoy this interview.
This is TRBM Ammo Edition. If you're a published author and want to make a living writing books and selling them to avid readers, you've come to the right place. There's simply no program that's more successful at driving readers towards the books you've written. So the only thing you have to worry about is writing a great book. And the system with Enamo takes care of the rest. Thanks for listening to this conversation.
The last month found me wrestling with the death of a good friend of mine. He also happens to be a cat. And because he was a cat that I'd had for 15 years, I felt like I had to always qualify the kind of grief that I was feeling and tell people that, you know, I understand it's just a cat, you know, and I would try to like minimize that. And what I realized I was doing was stuffing all of the grief and not allowing myself to really express it because I had to minimize it at the same time. And so what it brought to mind for me was in The Legend of Bagger Vance, Michael very first meets Bagger when Juna is drunk and making a fool of himself. And so he sees immediately Ranulf in this sort of like broken condition. And then not too much later, after Ranulf is signed up to play this golf tournament, he finds Ranulph in the bathroom, if I'm remembering correctly, with some ladies. And he's a little bit appalled by his bad behavior. And Bagger Vance says, let him have his moment. And I'm paraphrasing, so I apologize if I'm getting anything wrong. But for me, when I read that, there was something incredibly powerful about this idea of like the God figure of this book, the person who, for all intents and purposes, has no flaws, says, let the guy grieve, let him have his space, let him have his moment. I have a big mission for him. And I thought that was really powerful. So in no podcast that I've listened to with you so far, have I heard somebody actually stop on this moment. So if you don't have anything to say, it's been a long time since you wrote the book, I understand. But that's where I wanted to start, because I think it's a really powerful moment. And I think there are a lot of people who get stopped along the way because they don't process grief. So I'll shut up now and let you go.
Well, let me not talk about that, but I'll say that I had a cat for years that accompanied me on my journey. And when he got killed, he got hit by a car. That was, it was like losing a human being. Yeah. And an animal has a presence in a family or with a person as big as a human being, or even bigger sometimes, because they're so honest and straightforward. You know, there's no deception or anything like that. So I'm not, this doesn't have anything to do with Bagger Vance, but I can certainly relate to grieving over somebody, and you think, oh, it's only a cat, but it's not only a cat. You know, it's particularly one you've had for such a long time. I'm sure the bond between you guys was really, really deep. It certainly was for me. I think about that cat is like just about the best friend I ever had. And, an animal's never going to betray you, never going to hold anything back, never have any secrets, you know, that a second life that they live, you know, or if they have a second life, it's just their life as a cat or a dog. I think that moment in Bagger Vance, I kind of regretted it after I wrote it, because I didn't want to see, at first I didn't want Hardy, the young boy, to see Juna in this kind of bad light. But then I thought, you know, this is the way it should be. He should see it like this, and he should be told to, give him that space, let him do his thing. So I'm not sure, Jody. I'm not sure that answers what you're bringing up.
Yeah, to the degree that I think there is something powerful, and for any listeners, read the book. Because that scene is very powerful and will be with me for a long, long time. I'm a flawed person. I talk a lot about that in this podcast. I make a lot of mistakes along the way. I have a strange relationship with alcohol and different things like that. And you talk quite a bit about the resistance of like drugs and alcohol and things like that. So I'm very familiar with resistance. I'm using this word. I'll let you describe quickly for the listeners, even though you've described it so many times, what resistance is in your own words.
Resistance to me, the word I use with a capital R, is that negative force that tries to stop us as novelists or as any kind of artists or creators from doing our work, and will undermine us, make us sick, sabotage us, distract us, help us to procrastinate, to go down various rabbit holes of clickbait and stuff like that, and do all the things that we do to sabotage ourselves. So that's what resistance is to me. It comes in many, 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 many forms, as I'm sure you know, Jody. I was listening to your thing about getting sick, or grieving. Grief is another thing. And anyway, so resistance is the number one demon dragon that we have to slay every morning before we, you know, can get to do our work.
That hits home. You start right away in the Daily Press Field, which is your newest book. Thank you for the copy. It's an amazing book. I've got it right behind me there on my shelf. It'll be linked in the show notes, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. But that's right where you start. Like the moment you wake up, something is telling you, like, hit the snooze button, or I'm still sick, like COVID is still lingering, or whatever it might be. Something's always telling you, just take it easy today. And I think it's really easy to obey that voice. I don't win the battle with resistance as much as I would like to. So I wonder, You talk about feeling like once you're into a project, it's a little bit easier to win the battle on a daily basis against resistance. For people who are new to this concept or feel like they're on the precipice, what are the kinds of things that you like to tell them? This maybe give you a leg up or an advantage to break through.
I mean, it's all about self-discipline. Self-discipline, not discipline, but self-discipline. Yeah. And self-reinforcement, self-validation, being your own coach. The concept that I write about in The War of Art and in another book called Turning Pro is the idea of thinking of yourself as a professional. But certainly when you are into a project, that makes it much easier because you know that every day that you slack off, it's going to cost you, you know, 3 or 4 days to make up for that. So you have to build momentum and really reinforce yourself as you go. In fact, while I was waiting this hour, because I remember we had a mix-up of what hour we were going to do this. I'm going to show you my wall here. I don't know if you can see this. The tippy top thing, I just put that up there right now, that row of just doing an outline of scenes for a new book that I'm working on. So the point being that if you can look at something as a project rather than you're just sort of pooping along day to day and you don't know what the hell you're doing, then it gives a certain urgency to something. You know, here I am working on this thing. I got to finish the motherfucker.
What is author marketing mastery through optimization, you ask? I'm going to tell you. It's the best way for us authors to make a living selling our books. Are you tired of hearing gurus tell you your book is only good enough to be a lead magnet for services? Are you tired of feeling like you have to be a slave to social media and then frustrated when the time you spend doesn't actually help you sell books? I was too, until I found Ammo. Ammo is the only program that reliably produces results, and it works for anyone. Is it hard work? You bet. Do you have to overcome some of your own prejudices to make Ammo work for you? Absolutely. But rather than being another program that rah-rah shishkoon boss tries to get you emotionally excited only to offer unclear methods, Ammo shows you how to design profitable ads step by step through a unique, highly tested and targeted formula. The founder, Steve Piper, is a data-loving, formula-driven author who escaped the kingdom of Amazon to build a platform for himself where he sold directly to his readers and built a loyal following and millions of copies sold. With Ammo, you know who's reading your books, how to contact them, and what they want to read next. If you've always been frustrated with Amazon's wall of mystery of not knowing who's reading your books and losing 50 to 70% of your hard-earned money that you're making through sales, Ammo solves all of those problems by putting you in the driver's seat and showing you how to fulfill your books directly to your readership. Click the link in the show notes to learn more.
I'm curious about some of the less apparent versions of resistance. So I will use myself as an example because I think it'll be tangible. Writing is my first love. And everything that I've done, including starting this podcast, was in service of the idea that I would build an audience to whom I could sell my books and build relationships as readers. The podcast has nothing to do with my readers for the most part. People are also writers on this journey. I didn't understand what I was doing in the beginning. And so I've cultivated a parallel audience of people who don't necessarily read my work. And I'm happy that I've done this. But then, you know, I also started a company called Self-Published Author Cooperative to help authors get their books into bookstores that don't have the traditional means. You can talk a little bit about that because maybe with the exception of The War of Art, all of your nonfiction books are published outside of the traditional stream, maybe small press, maybe self-published. I don't know exactly how you're considering them today, but there are moments, I think, inside of this where we have these ideas of how to get our writing into the hands of other people. And some of that even, I feel like, maybe can be resistance. Have you experienced that? And what could you say about it?
Pretty much I have a kind of a rule of thumb where I say, when in doubt, it's resistance. You know, when you think, maybe this is legitimate, this reason that I have to, it probably is resistance. Yeah. It probably is not. And that goes hand in hand with self-doubt. That's when the thing kind of really comes up, when you're doubting the value of whatever it is that you're doing. Now, I'm not sure I understood, Jody, what you meant by how that connects with self-publishing.
Sure.
You mean that trying to work on self-publishing is drawing you away from actually doing your writing? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I am excited to have this piece of the conversation as well, because I do believe that as a self-published author, in most cases, you are forced to wear multiple hats. So you have to be the writer. In some sense, you have to build your editing team around you. You have to build your proofreading team and beta readers and all these things. And then when the book is ready to go, you have to work with your artists, your layout team, your typeset team, and then you've got to launch it out into the world, and you have to be the marketer. It's like a ridiculous amount of work to get a book out there. And so I think that resistance is all over the place in the self-published author's world.
Well, I agree completely. And everything, all those things that you described, they're things that, like, Hemingway never had to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because there was a whole apparatus, right? All he had to do was turn it into Maxwell Perkins, and the book took care of itself, you know? But that was another world. And that world is long gone.
Yeah.
So just like you, I have to do all of those things. And I think most of us writers are introverts. And if you can generalize it, we really don't like it out there and flog our own stuff, you know, to the world. And particularly, it's really hard to say, hey, buy my stuff, you know, read my, you know.
Yeah.
You really want a third person to say that on your behalf. But unfortunately, you have to do it in this world today. Yeah. And there, we all have resistance to that as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, to me, overcoming the resistance of doing the writing is a piece of cake compared with overcoming my resistance to speaking in public or doing anything like that. But again, if you're going to be a pro, you just have to do it. Ryan Holiday is very articulate on this subject, and he's a great one for, you know, he is.
Yeah,
right?
I hope someday to have him on the podcast as well. I love your interactions with him on the Daily Stoic. You guys are brilliant when you get together too.
He is a great marketer of his own stuff, a fantastic marketer of his own stuff. And he's, if you ask him a question about that, he's kind of merciless in the sense of, you got to do it. Yeah. You know, you're kidding yourself if you don't do it. So that's a challenge we all have to face, and we all have resistance to.
I am strangely soothed to hear you say that, because I think that there was a part of me that we probably all do this to a degree, or, anyways, I had anticipated our conversation in some corners, and I was prepared to follow up questions that I assumed we would have in this chess game of an interview. So your answer is completely different than I thought. I sort of thought, because a lot of your fiction career has been through traditional publishers, that you might feel a little bit hesitant to the idea of a writer going out on their own and self-publishing, especially when it comes to fiction, because fiction's a tough thing. It's really difficult to write a great novel, and it's easy to get lost in the entertainment value and forget that you have to do 9 different things at once. So I was a little bit afraid that you might just say, hey, until you get a traditional publisher, you have to keep pushing at the gates.
Well, I actually, almost all of my fiction has been published by traditional publishers.
Yep.
And I am really leery. I have a new one just done. And with my girlfriend, Diana, we now have our own little kind of publishing company. But I don't think I'm going to try to bring it out that way, because it's just too hard. Yep. And also, sort of like what you were talking, Jody, about the audience that, for your podcast. Yep. Like, my audience for my blog and stuff like that are also other writers. And they're interested in my books, like The War of Art or, you know, The Daily Pressfield, that are encouraging them to in their writing journey, but they don't give a shit about my fiction.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And I can't get them to read it. I can't get anybody to cross over. It's a whole other audience. Yeah. So fiction is a really tough animal. I haven't found any way to do it except the mainstream way. And even then, as I'm sure you know, and all of your listeners know, the mainstream publishers don't do a damn thing for you. You got to do everything yourself in terms of promoting
the book. Yeah, exactly.
In fact, they're asking you how big is your list? Yep. How many followers do you have and what can you do for yeah. us? So I haven't found any good answer for that at yeah. all. You know?
Yeah. The couple of things that do work and they're hit and miss for a long, long time is advertising. If you can hang in there and you have a budget to advertise, things like Facebook and Instagram, YouTube have made advertising somewhat affordable. But it's like getting the death by a thousand cuts when you're advertising, because you're not going to figure out what resonates for so long that you're going to spend a lot of money getting there. It can work. And then the idea of getting in bookstores can work as well. I think self-published authors have a real challenge, and I am speaking directly to novelists right now in this case, have a real challenge because they don't unite. That introversion that we tend to struggle with, the loneliness of the work, oftentimes leads us not to make those deep connections with other novelists. And I dare say, I know this is somewhat true for myself, not terribly, and I've worked a lot on my own self in this area, is a sense of competitiveness. Like, my books might have the same audience as your books. And so if I'm friends with you and you're successful, what if I'm jealous?
Yeah, I know this. Like, I sort of avoid friendships with other writers because when I'm sitting down yeah. to work, I don't want to think that there are like 10,000 other guys and gals trying to do the same thing. I want to think, oh, I'm the only one doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't want to have a kind of a network. I mean, I have writer friends, but they're usually like in the movies or they're doing something yeah. that's not really competitive at all with yep. me. So, yeah. And actually, I found that I had a little publishing company, I still do, that brought out The War of Art and things like that. And for a while, we were publishing other authors.
Oh, okay.
And but I realized that writers are such a pain in the ass
yeah.
that I couldn't stand to deal with them, you know, because they're so insecure. They always want to be reassured and they always are pissed off at you because you're not doing enough yeah. for them, which of course right. you're not. And I feel the same yeah. way. So finally I just said, I'm only publishing myself and it's just too much of a pain in the ass to help these crazy.
It crossed my mind. You were having a conversation with Sean. And I mean, this is years ago, but I think Sean, right? Sean Quayne, or am I mispronouncing his name now?
Okay. Yeah, that's
so you're
right.
having a conversation uh-huh. yeah. with Sean and talking a little bit about having that publisher and that relationship that you had. And you had never necessarily that I heard referenced whether you published other people, but I started to get the idea that maybe you did on occasion. And that was another moment where I thought, oh, okay, I'm comforted that I'm not the only one who has these ideas to try to expand beyond doing this thing for myself. I'm curious, as for your motivations of starting to publish other authors, was it an altruistic notion for you, or was it an advent that you thought it would be maybe advantageous for your own ability to reach more readers? It was
just that we sort of stumbled onto, Sean and I, books that we thought were really good
yeah.
and we thought that they should get out
yeah.
there. And so we thought it was altruistic and we thought
yeah.
we wanted to get, you know, the author out there, but we also thought we could make money.
Yeah.
And, but again, it's you just, as an independent, you just don't have the resources. Mm-hmm. At least I've never figured out how to, you know, get the books out there and get the audience. In fact, the one book that we did that really did work was the reason it worked. It was it's a long story, but one of the two guys that wrote it was out there flogging the book all the time.
Mm.
He had a yep. business, a security business, that he was constantly going to people and trying to promote the business. And while he did that, he promoted the book. And so that kind of is what you and I are talking about.
Yeah.
That if you're the writer of the book, you got to get out there and promote it. That made all the difference yeah. that he was out there. And again, it wasn't a big thing. Nobody was making any big money.
Sure.
I think probably total, we might've all made like maybe 30,000 a year split between four
yeah.
people or something like that. So nobody was getting rich off
free
of it,
pizza
but at least
every week, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's been my experience, is that I have ideas of ways that I know, okay, I can actually help an author. I can build a relationship. We can work together to get our books out there. And then you realize the immense amount of work that it takes. It is building a new business. And that I think is a huge challenge. every business that you build that you're the primary operator for is going to take you away from writing. You do yeah. talk about something quite a bit. 4 hours seems to be the cap for your creative output on writing. I imagine that there are at least another 6 hours in your day where you're doing your Instagram reels that you're doing, or any other number of things, podcast interviews, for example. How do you decide where you position these things in the day? And can you push past that 4 hours if needed, or is it really the quality just suffers too much? Do you have like rules, I guess?
I don't have rules, but 4 hours was like when I was young and strong. Yeah. Now, if I can do like 2.5, that's like the outer limits for me. And I definitely don't push past that because I feel it's a point of diminishing returns for me. The stuff starts, it's like going to the gym. You can only work out so long before your body just gives up, you know? So, but I have heard people, and there are a lot of people who can work 10 hours. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. But you're right. I do have in my day another, you know, maybe not 6 hours, but hours where I am having to do other stuff that you just have to do. Podcasts, you know, like you say, Instagram, that kind of thing. I just try to compartmentalize and try to be as much of a professional as I can, you know, and say, like, when we're finished here, like I showed you on my bulletin board, I got about an hour in on that. We'll do our podcast. You know, I'll take a little break and then I'll try get back for maybe another couple hours of real work, you know? And I have to sort of wing it day by day, because you just sometimes more opportunities show up than other times. Other times I find I'm just burned out. I just can't take it anymore. And I just have to, you know, stick with the work.
I like to hear that too. Because of the level of success that you've had, many of the people listening to this podcast would look at you as being like the dream scenario. You spent 40-ish years, I'm using that number specifically, getting to the kind of the overnight success. And you always talk about, I shouldn't say always, you often reference the moment where you quit your job to write your first novel, not really understanding what all was entailed in that. And it seems as if you went straight from there into a desert. Do you feel like that was a bad choice that you made at the time? I'm not going to ask you, would you do it over again? But knowing what you know now, what are your thoughts?
It's a really good question, Joey. I certainly, you know, there was a lot of suffering involved in that after the first thing flamed out and I flamed out with it. But looking back, it's easy when you look back. I probably wouldn't have done it any other way, because for me, at that point when I started, I think I was 22 years old, I was had no real experience of life. You know, I was quite sheltered growing up, and I had no business trying to put anything on paper that anybody else was going to read. So it was certainly fitting that I had to, you know, stumble and bumble through the stuff of life before it, you know, I felt like I had something to say. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I believe it's Flannery.
Sometimes you got to be really stupid, you know, don't you think, Jody? You got to be ignorant. I mean, I hear a lot of stories about entrepreneurs, and they, when they talk about when they started a business, and they look back and they say, I was a complete idiot to start it. I didn't know anything about it, you know, I just floundered and somehow it worked or it didn't work or whatever. But I think being dumb is a really good thing at a certain point, you know, because if you really knew how hard it was going to be, and what it was going to entail, you'd be crazy to do these things, like to play music or to, you know, be an actor or something. You got to be crazy.
I'm 4 books into a 9-book series, and every single day lately, I find myself thinking, boy, it would be great if I had some central location for all of my notes, all of my plot points, character names, family lineages, you name it. I wish it was in one place, because
Let's be honest, the way that I am using Microsoft Word as a word processor and have 55 different documents to keep track of all of the series details that I need to access, I'm taking more time opening up files wondering, why did I name this one that? Why did I name this one that? And not getting the information I need. Enter Scrivener. You guys know that I do not advertise for things unless A, I'm using them myself, and B, I think that you could up your game, sell more books, do better marketing, and get yourself in the game better. And that is why I am now partnered with Scrivener. If you use the link in the show notes, you get a 30-day free trial, and then you can sign up as well for a discount. Click the link in the show notes to learn more. That is absolute truth. I have said similar things before, and I've even taken it so far as to say, because I am not at the point yet where many people know my name, I am not at the place where I can fully support my family on selling my novels, which is the dream. And so I'm able to look at it and say, there are days where the resistance I meet first thing in the morning is, had I known, you know, what I know now, when I started this journey, there's just no chance. I've made so much good money selling houses and doing real estate investing and all kinds of other things that are fun and give you adrenaline and get you really excited. But once you're in, there's really no way out but through, it feels like. I don't know if everybody can relate to that, but I feel like once you've made this commitment, I'm going to write these novels and people are going to read them, and it's going to be this amazing experience of community through these stories. You just have to do it.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you think about what would happen to you if you stopped, it's nothing good, right? You're just going to enter some kind of spiral, you know, whether it involves various vices and crime, you know, it's nothing good is going to happen.
With that in mind, you talk about ego and this idea of the ego being maybe the opposing force to the muse. And I'm curious, did you ever tap into the ego along the journey? I'm talking specifically between like that first failed novel and your success. Did you ever tap into the ego to keep you going? Or are you very firmly of the belief that that is not doable?
That's a great question. I think that when I say the ego as a writer, it's when you're attached to the outcome of something, you know, you're thinking, this is a great idea. This is going to be a hit, and blah, blah. And that's the worst way you can think about things, or where you start to say to yourself, what is the market looking for? You know, and let me hit that area. Oh, there hasn't been a great Western. Let me write a Western. You know, I mean, a lot of people work that way and make money that way and thrive that way in their own way. But I don't think it's you, and it's certainly not me. And like Rick Rubin, you know, he is the godfather of hip hop. You know, he's really very strong in that. Like if you're in the studio trying to make a hit, it's never going to happen. You know, what you got to really do is ask yourself, what do I love? What at the moment? Is there something in me at the moment? And let me do that without caring or thinking so much about how it's going to be received. And just, you know, following what you love at the moment seems to be the only way that we're. And certainly, I think on the spiritual dimension, which is why we're really in it, whether we want to say it or not. That's really the only way the muse is really going to come through for you. You know, that's what she's looking for. So I fought when I went, let's say ego, let me put it a different way. Self-consciousness. That was what I fought for years, 30 years, sitting down at the page and sort of, whether I put it in these words, I was sort of thinking, well, okay, now I'm writing, you know, so let me start writing like a writer, you know, or terrible, bad thing. Yeah. Only bad things come out of that. Whereas when you just sort of give up in a sense and just say, okay, I'm just going to put down whatever shit comes into my head, you know, or whatever dumb story I like, that's when good things start to happen. But it's so hard to do. to let go of the ego.
There are a couple of things. So there are several that you just talked about. One is Rick Rubin, an area where he is far more experienced and seasoned than I am. And so I say this with a grain of salt, but I disagree with one aspect of his idea. And that is that, like, you should write for yourself and let the world judge whether it's good or not. Actually, if I say it that way, I agree with him. But he sometimes comes across as saying, don't give a shit what anybody thinks of your art. Just go out and create what's in your heart. Sometimes I feel like that leads to a perspective that we have no responsibility to our audience. And if you wrote The War of Art not thinking that you were giving of your hard-earned experience and that other people could bleed less because of that, then The War of Art would not be what The War of Art is. I can say that confidently. And so it may be that I'm parsing words here, but I know a lot of people who have listened to Rick Rubin who get this idea in their head that they can do stream of consciousness, send it out into the world, and fuck anybody who doesn't think it's a good book because they're just stupid.
Hmm. Well, I know exactly what you mean, Jody. I mean, certainly there are certain rules of what a work, yeah, a fiction or anything else has to be, right? And you can't violate those rules.
Yeah.
You know, but within those rules, you know, you can come from a place that only you love,
yeah,
or that only you think you love. I mean, an analogy that I use, maybe this is not perfect, but when Steve Jobs had the idea for the iPhone, nobody was waiting for the iPhone, right? He had to lead them. He had this vision. And even he, I'm sure, never foretold the various apps and all the other bullshit that was going to come with it. But he had to lead the audience. So he was thinking about it. He said, I'm sure he was saying to himself, people are going to love this fucking thing when I get it out there. You know, all I got to do is get it. So he did have the audience in mind, but he wasn't aiming at some sort of pre-established niche that he knew he was going to hit. He was going to invent this niche. And once you saw it, then hopefully you were going to go for it. That's my theory anyway. And certainly, like when I was working on The Legend of Bagger Vance, I thought to myself, this is the dumbest idea I've ever had. You know, a mystical golf novel from a guy nobody's ever heard of, a golf novel. What could be dumber than that, you know? And all the way through, I thought that this has no commercial potential. But I was just seized by it, just like Rick Rubin would say. You know, I just had to do it. And to my amazement, it sold faster and stronger than anything else I had ever done. So that kind of made me a little bit of a believer that you should trust your instincts a little
absolutely bit. So then that absolutely leads to the question, even though you thought that maybe it was like nobody could love it, did you also think in your head, like, this is a crazy fun idea, like to mask the Bhagavad Gita in a golf novel? I mean, was there part of you that thought like,
oh yeah, definitely. I thought it was great. I thought I love this. I loved it. I can't wait to read this myself. Yeah. But I thought, who else is going to be besides me? You know.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of both. I didn't think nobody's going to lie. I just thought, in the commercial environment as we know it, it doesn't fit into any category.
I agree with you, by the way. That novel should not be commercial. It doesn't actually fit what you think of when you think of commercial. You think of Stephen King when you think of commercial, or Jack Reacher and things like that. So that is possibly the muse cooperating with you, right? For making the right in there.
Yeah.
Okay. So one question I have for you too, that is from what you were saying previously, is the ego that you defined is maybe a little differently or different than I think of it. The ego I think of is sometimes the imaginings of your fame. It's this deep drive in you to be successful and to have recognition. And I don't always know what's going to do it, but I can't remember a time in my life when I haven't been convinced that I'm destined to be known. Is that ego in your mind? It's okay if it is. And you can tell me, like, that's why you haven't made it, because you're stuck thinking you're destined for something.
No, I think it's that thing is definitely a positive, Jody. I would call it just ambition, you know, But it is really intertwined. It's interesting, you know. There are people who really are egomaniacs, yeah. Just, you know, think, you know, and usually they're people who have, you know, nothing going for them at all, you know. But it's also a very legitimate thing if you're Tom Brady and you just got picked, you know, number 199 in the draft, to say, hey, this is bullshit. I'm the best quarterback out here, and I'm going to show these sons of bitches, you know, and I'm going to work really, really, really hard, and I know my value, and I'm not going to sell my value short. So it is a fine distinction, but I think ambition and aspiration are a very good thing. They're the fuel. They're the rocket fuel. That being said, I don't think that necessarily achieving quote unquote fame or that stuff means a damn thing in the real world. You know, it's really, to me, all about the work. That's where it all comes from.
Definitely agree with you. I mean, I think that validation, because it can only happen in the present, is something that you can't measure by. When a novel like Carrie gets recognized for what it was, I think that that's a really big deal. I think when a novel like The Legend of Bagger Vance gets recognized, it's a signal to people that something great has been done. It's when you start to like hang your identity on that it becomes, I think, an issue. And it seems, you know, referencing Tom Brady, very clear that he never hung his identity on his accomplishments. He always was saying, this is where we're going. This is what we're doing.
Yeah, what's next? Yeah, that's all that was like, great. A lot of people are like that, you know? Just won the Super Bowl, what's next?
I like that. I personally do. I know that there are plenty of people who feel like you short sell the present if you're asking what's next, or if you can only glory in your successes for 15 minutes. But, you know, my wife has said before, you will never be satisfied. And I was like, oh, I'm satisfied with you, but otherwise you are correct. Like, there's no satisfaction in this. all right, so last question about the ego. Is there is a fairly popular business influencer out there by the name of Alex Hormozi. Are you familiar with him?
No.
His idea is like that you just show up every single day, do the thing, regardless of how you feel. And if you stack up enough hours over a long enough period of time, you are guaranteed success. He's the one who talked about burning dirty fuel. He calls ego sometimes like diesel. He's like, I'm not saying that you should be angry at your father and aim to prove him wrong and show him what an idiot he is. But he's like, if I didn't have my dad to try to prove wrong, I would not have woken up many, many days to do what I am doing. And he's like, now I've had to heal from the damage I did myself, but don't necessarily say no to burning what he calls like the bad ego necessarily, like using your hubris to get a place. Framed that way, have you experienced that, or do you still see that as just being kind of like that's the cost of doing business?
I have burned some dirty fuel in my day, that's true, but I certainly think that our aspiration should be to get beyond that, and that you know, it can be useful, and I'm sure we all have that, you know, that drive, you know. To prove somebody wrong, or to prove, you know, that we aren't the bum that they think we are, that kind of thing. But at some point, you have to get to a higher level than that, and be working for a different purpose than that.
Yeah.
You know, like I think of the great swordsman Miyamoto Musashi, right? By the time he was doing his swords training when he was like the greatest swordsman in Japan, blah, blah, blah. He certainly wasn't doing that to prove his dad wrong. You know, he was into the higher levels of what this was all about, you know, the aspect of greatness and the aspect of surrender to, and all that sort of stuff. So I do think we got to get beyond using dirty fuel.
Sure. With that in mind, I'm curious, do you have conversations with like your future self about where you're headed, what you want to accomplish in the coming months, years, decades?
No.
You're fully here. Like, this is what I'm doing right now. This is a project.
I'm sure you, I'm a believer in the muse. Yeah. I'm a believer in inspiration coming from another dimension of reality, and that we never know what the goddess is going to give us next, what assignment she's going to give us next. And in my experience, it's always a surprise. And it's always something you say, me? Why should, what do I, you know? I don't think you can look ahead. Yeah. It's kind of a fool's journey to look ahead, I think, because life changes and you just never know. The goddess knows, but we don't. You know, if we could get a look at that file, mm-hmm. if we could break into the file yeah. cabinet, that might be very interesting to us, but we can't, yeah. you know? So I'm just a believer in, I know I'm going to keep working as long as I can. As long as there's gas in the tank, I'm going to keep mm-hmm. doing it. But what exactly I'm going to be doing, I don't know. And I'm just trying to hold myself open for whatever yeah. it is.
Based on that, though, I wonder, there's a passage in the Bible. If I knew where it was, I'd probably be a better person of faith. But anyways, it's that, that God gives you the desires of your heart. And I grew up people telling me that that meant that you didn't have any say in what you were going to do. You had to wait to be told like what you were supposed to do. I came to realize on my own journey that actually meant that there were desires already in my heart, that they were burbling. And that if I listened to that thing and I embraced that, those desires were in my heart. They'd been given to me. And all I had to do was act on them to bring them into reality. I think that's why I'm a writer today. It's because I finally listened and I said, there's nothing else that always speaks. This one thing always speaks to me. It's always this desire, this longing. So I follow it. I think that you would agree that like the muse has pretty much stamped you as a writer, as a novelist. You said a lot of times, and I agree, you're not writing self-help books, but you're writing something in the wisdom literature. So he's made you a novelist and a wisdom literature writer. And you can probably say that as long as you're kicking, you're writing one of those two things. There's no chance you're changing, right? Or do you really feel that the muse could like pull your strings and be like, ah, time to go?
I think the muse could pull your strings. I mean, we evolve, right? I mean, did Bruce Springsteen think yeah. that he was going to be doing Springsteen on Broadway? Okay. Or, you know,
yeah.
You never know what the next phase may be. You know, actors then become directors yeah. and then become mentors to other writers and other directors and other actors. Mm. So you never know. I think it's probably all... For all of us, it's in a kind of a groove. It's all there's a theme that carries yeah. through, but
maybe we don't always know what it is.
But it can yeah. evolve, and we'll be doing things we never thought mm. we would do.
You've talked enough on other podcasts about the actual prayer to the muses. I would encourage people to listen to any number of interviews because it's a common theme. I don't necessarily want to retread there, but as we're starting to talk about the spiritual dimension of all of this work, there's also a spiritual dimension to things like marketing, which my show often focuses on. I want to know from you how much of the things that you do, like working on your Instagram and putting out your series on Instagram, you've had many of them, how much of that is sort of data driven versus how much of it is a gut reaction that people need to hear this right now? And if I do it, there's a good chance that it will reap positive results.
It's not data driven yeah. and it's really kind of, the way you expressed it was pretty good there, Jody. I'll have a kind of a theme will come, you know, that I think, you know, this would help people if I could put this theme out there, you know, that, and it's not something that you can do in one, you know, 2 minute thing or one 30 second thing. It's sort of the, you know, like a series that I'll do on Instagram might be 20, you know, 5 minute or 3 minute yeah. videos. So they're like a little book if you put yeah. them all together. I'm really doing it partly just to sort of to show the flag, you know, to keep the brand yeah. alive, but also mostly to as a gift, yeah. you know, because I think they'll
help people. They help me. I've heard so many people talk about how much your Instagram bits have helped. Your podcasts have helped me. Your books have helped me. We're not going to talk.
Well, that's good yeah. to hear, you know, because it's sometimes you don't get a lot of feedback on that. Oh. So, you know, thanks for that,
yeah,
Jody.
Absolutely. It's the truth. We are coming up at the 45-minute mark. That's how much time I reserved with you. So as much as I would love to have a much longer conversation with you, I want to respect your time. We already, like you said, had kind of a whatever snafu happened there. But
we can do this again, Jody,
okay,
if you
perfect.
Want to.
I would really love that because I feel like we really didn't dive into a lot of the other questions I have. And something I think would be a real treat is to discuss with the listeners of this podcast how you actually implant your themes into your novels, because you don't talk about that in a lot of other podcasts. And I know that it's something that's very precious to you, and it's precious to me as well. Like I said, I learned as much from Bagger Vance as any of the other books that I read by you is just like actually seeing the characters go through the moment. And then I am in their shoes living that moment. So again, thank you. How can people best connect with you if they want to follow along with the journey? And then also do talk about the Daily Press Field a little bit. It's an amazing book. Thank you again for the copy. And we can wrap up.
The Daily Press Field is actually was an idea that Ryan Holiday gave me. He said, you know, because his book, The Daily Stoic, we were talking and he said, you should write a book like this, you know. So I started, you know, because you have so much content. So I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, people come to me, as I'm sure they come to you, Jody, and they say, I've got a book in me. How do I write a book? Yeah. You know, or how do I do any sort of creative enterprise? And I thought this, a book like The Daily Press Field, a 365-day book that you start day one, takes you all through years, like a perfect way to get that across, that sort of to make it a book that you could put beside your laptop day one as you're starting a project, and you can kind of go through it one day at a time. And so it's structured that way, like as you were talking, referring to earlier, chapter one of The Daily Press Field says, resistance wakes up with me. And it talks about how the minute I open my eyes, and this is true for everybody, there's this negative force there. And in other words, that's, to me, that's the perfect thought for the first day of any project, that you have to accept in your heart that this is your life from now on. Every morning, the dragon's going to be there, and you're going to have to slay it. And then let's take it on to day two, it's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So anyway, that was the point of the Daily Press Field. Just to say one thing here on the subject of marketing. Like I say, I have this little company with my girlfriend, Diana, who just walked in. And one of the things that we thought as far as selling the book, because we're independently publishing it, and the books are, you know, like there's 1,000 books in our garage right now that Diana puts together one by one. And we decided to have what we're trying to think of as publishing above and beyond, to do something that Amazon can't do and that bookstores can't do. And so we offer two options. You can always buy the book on Amazon, just get the book. But the thing you have behind you there, and right behind your left ear, is a package that we sell for a kind of a premium price that has not just the book, but a companion journal and illustrated cards of the illustrator, Vic Juhas, and all kinds of goodies in it, so that it makes that package is like a great gift that you could give to someone if you had a, you know, someone in your family that's struggling to write a novel or whatever it is, that you could give them this, and it would really be a great, you know, above and beyond just a book. And then we have another smaller version of that that has not quite all those goodies, but it's, and the books are signed by me and Vic, the illustrator, so that it becomes not just a book, but a kind of an artifact or a talisman, where you can say, oh man, this is like the guy signed it himself, you know, that kind of thing. So that's one way where we're trying to publish, not in a race to the bottom, but a race to the top, to have more. You know, people will have to pay more, but they get a lot more. And they get a lot more than you could get anyplace else. You can't get anything like this anyplace else. Anyway, that's my long version of what the Daily Press Field is. And anybody can find out about it or reach me. My website is just my name, Stephen Pressfield, Stephen with a V.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. Since you mentioned the different illustrations by Victor, I am curious, and this is really just for me, probably nobody else, but the illustration of the banana breakfast, is that actually, did he base that on a younger picture of you, or is it just generally a guy eating a banana?
You know, that's, I guess, you know, that's a great question. Because it does sort of
yeah,
look
like. Yeah, it does
like
enough. That was like, maybe he did.
Yeah. I think he must have found a picture somewhere and copied it. Maybe he's just brilliant and he can kind of peel back the ears. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen. I would love to do this again in the future. And best of luck on your new book.
I will do it, Jody. And thank you for what you're doing here. God bless you on your novel writing. And whatever you're doing, you're on the right track. Keep doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to TRBM. The theme music was provided by the ever-talented Christopher Talon. And hey, if you liked what you heard, share this show with other readers, because what's the point of telling stories if nobody's listening?